720. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Lots to do on the program today. We're going to be giving you an update on Outcome Health, which is a medical startup that we've been talking about for months. They have been embroiled in much controversy, but there is an update for you. So we're going to be talking about that a little bit later in the program, as well as we're going to be talking about the Federal Reserve in light of the leadership change there. So we're going to be talking about that just a little bit later. But right now we're joined by Noam Scheiber, who is a reporter at the New York Times. And there is a paper that was recently released by some economists that took a look at some data points around job listings and found that tens of millions of Americans were living in areas where there was basically a pretty small number of employers posting most of the job listings. And so there is a piece in the New York Times written by our guest, Noam Scheiber. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be here.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you taking out part of your Saturday to be with us. Well, talk us through this story, because normally when we look at consolidation, we see it as consumer. We really think about how it benefits us in the end. But this really looks more at it in terms of workers, this piece that you wrote for New York Times. And it's very, very interesting. So talk us through this a bit.
Yeah, so the basic idea is that workers benefit when employers are competing for their services. So if you are looking for a job and you have a couple options, chances are those employers are going to bid up your wages as they compete for your services, particularly in a tight job market like we're having now. But if there are just not that many employers competing to hire you, then it's a lot more likely that your wages will stay flat because the employers are not going to bid it up. And as a lot of industries have consolidated over the past few decades, what you're seeing is more and more workers are working in places where there just aren't that many options. As you mentioned, the paper that these economists did looked on Career Builder, and they just looked at tens of thousands of job listings over the course of a couple of years, and they found that in a lot of areas and in a lot of jobs and a lot of labor markets, often there's just a couple of employers posting jobs. And that really does undermine your leverage when you're on the job market.
Certainly. And you know, we think of that in terms of being like a very classic move, very common knowledge. When you're trying to get a raise at work, you go get a competing offer. But we don't think about that often on the front end in terms of limited options.
That's right. Yeah. And the mechanism works pretty much the same way. You know, if you've got employers who know that they don't really have to compete with other employers, they're going to hold the wage that they're posting on a site like Career Builder, they're going to hold that down, and they're not going to feel a lot of urgency about raising it. And so, I think we're starting to have to think about what the consolidation means for workers and not just for consumers. The paper actually looked at a number of occupations, and some were more competitive than others, but. At the top end, you had one of the ones that I write about, mechanics. I looked at farm equipment mechanics, and if you look at that particular occupation, there's just been a huge consolidation both in the companies that make the farm equipment over the past couple of decades, like John Deere. It used to be in the 80s, there were a lot of manufacturers, a lot of people making equipment, and now there's basically like three in the United States. And then on the other end, the companies that actually hire the mechanics tend to be the dealerships, the John Deere dealerships, and those have really consolidated too. You know, it used to be that there were a number of small-time independent dealerships, and they'd all hire mechanics, and now you have, in a lot of states, you have these kind of big dealership groups that own 6 or 8 or 12 or even 30 or 50 dealerships, and they're not really going to bid against one another. You know, they're just going to kind of set a wage, and if you don't like it, then you can go to another occupation. But if you want to work as a farm equipment mechanic, you're going to kind of have to take what they give you.
Right, right. Well, I think it's interesting this bringing up this point of wage stagnation or this factor of it, especially just last week in the program, we were talking a little bit about how we're about to see a lot more transparency around CEO to worker pay and the disparity between the two. And I think this is an interesting piece of that, too, as we're talking about wage stagnation in this country.
Yeah, no question. I mean, there's been a lot written about why, obviously, why wages have not grown, particularly since the late 90s, which was the last time we had a kind of sustained rise in wages. And, you know, there are a number of reasons for that. Obviously, foreign competition, a lot of industries are much more globalized, and so workers here are competing with workers in other countries that make a lot less. There's automation that's throwing workers out of work. But I think this is a real factor. I mean, if you look at the trends in, you know, say the 50 biggest industries. There was actually another paper that that came to similar conclusions by Barack Obama's Council of Economic Advisors in 2016, and they were getting at the same thing, and they found that if you look at the 50 largest industries, the share of the top companies in terms of revenue for all those industries has basically increased over the last 20 years or so. So it's a clear trend, and it's happening at the same time that wages are either, you know, stagnating or rising pretty weakly or falling for a lot of workers. So so I think it makes sense to think about the two in relationship to one another.
Right, certainly. And did you get the sense in reporting this story that there were vast differences in how this played out in different regions in the country?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely the case. I mean, in major metropolitan areas, really big cities, you do tend to have more options, even when an industry has consolidated and there aren't a ton of options in that industry. You've got, you know, a lot of other options for people with a certain set of skills, so it tends to be more competitive. But as you get out of cities, and it doesn't even have to be like the middle of nowhere, you know, just as you get into kind of smaller cities, exurban areas, it really does start to get a lot more consolidated, a lot less competitive. These economists in their paper did a kind of color-coded map of every sort of commute. It's called a commuting zone. That's you know, it's basically what it sounds like, the geographic area in which a normal person would consider commuting to an employer. And you see a lot, you know, you see all these big metro areas where it's pretty competitive. But as soon as you get outside that, even to kind of mid-sized cities, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, you know, Indianapolis, Ohio, Indiana, it's just really not that competitive, not nearly as competitive as you think. So this is a problem for a lot of people who live outside of, you know, Chicago, New York, LA, San Francisco, and in a handful of other big cities.
Certainly, and I know something, it's certainly a topic on a lot of minds here in Illinois and just outside of Chicago, as we see such an important area for agriculture, indeed.
No question, yeah. I mean, if you look at their map, once you get outside of Chicago and maybe the kind of inner suburbs, this really starts to kick in.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Well, thank you so much for being with us today and breaking this down. Noam Scheiber, reporter at New York Times. And everybody, if you follow me on Twitter, I will be sure and tweet this story out because I want you to read the entire thing. It's really, really a wonderful story with a lot of things to think about. Noam, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. We're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit. When we return, we're going to be talking about Outcome Health, which is a medical startup that we have been talking about for several months on this program. There is a new development in the ongoing saga of this startup. And then a little bit later in the program, we are going to be talking about the Federal Reserve. Changes there, many changes afoot. So lots to talk about. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is gorgeous outside, and I hope you are able to get outside and enjoy some of that sunshine. We got a couple days of it before it, you know, cools down again a little bit. So let us soak up the sunshine where we can here in our fine city. Okay, still lots to do on the program today. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to be talking about the Federal Reserve and many other topics. But right now we're joined by John Pletz, senior reporter at Crain's, who wrote about what is happening with Outcome Health, that medical startup. We have been talking about them for many, many months on this program. They had a ton of funding, but then they have really been plagued by a lot of controversy, including fraud allegations. So now there is a new development that seems to be a little bit of an olive branch between the company and its investigators. But joining us now to talk it all over, John Pletz, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Well, so talk us through this latest development with Outcome Health, and maybe for those who have not been following the story so carefully, a little bit of background on just exactly what the controversies are all about with this medical startup.
Well, it's a medical or healthcare advertising company, and they have TV screens and tablets in doctors' offices. They provide educational content and then also sell advertising to pharma companies. And the company's been growing really fast. It was one of the fastest growing startups in Chicago. And about a little over a year ago, they bought a competitor. Then they took in a huge investment, you know, $500 million, which is one of the biggest investments ever for, you know, a Chicago tech company. And then there was a story in the Wall Street Journal that accused them basically of charging advertisers for more screens than they had, and also in some cases maybe fudging some numbers. And not long after that, the investors sued them for fraud. So they were, you know, basically having issues with customers, having issues with their investors. That's just not where you want to be as a startup.
Certainly not. Right.
Yeah. Now they've sort of quietly they came to a deal with the investors. The lawsuit was settled. Both sides agreed to invest another $159 million into the business, but the founders are stepping down from day-to-day management as CEO and president. They move on to the board. The board ends up going from 3 members, 2 of whom are the founders, to 7 members. So they appear to have gotten that piece of the puzzle straightened out.
Which is really kind of, that's an admirable feat to be able to pull off that much, given how heated the controversy was. It seemed it was very, very contentious and really, really getting quite ugly, even just a few months ago. And to be able to turn that to where, like, okay, not only is this going to be okay, give us a little more time, but also more money, seems like an unbelievable feat.
Well, it is sort of remarkable, but then again, I can think of very few instances where you ever have a startup with its investors and founders in, you know, fighting it out in court. Usually that stuff is sort of handled quietly behind the scenes. So I think maybe cooler heads prevailed after, you know, 90 days or so. They looked at the situation and, you know, they had a choice. They could either fight it out in court, which would be a long, messy battle, and the company, sort of in limbo, or they could figure out a way to work together, take a look at the business, and if they thought, you know, this is still a good business and we can do some good things, then you get together and work it out. And that looks like what they did.
Right, right. And so do we have any sense of what the next moves are for the two people in leadership that are stepping down, given they were so very much at the, you know, very personally at the center of this controversy?
Well, given that they still own the majority of the shares in the company, I don't think they go away completely. Job one right now is they got to find a CEO. And you know, it's never easy to hand off any company from a founder to a new CEO, but you really complicate matters when you've got to rebuild trust with your customers, you've got to rebuild trust with your employees. You know, they've roughly lost a third of the employee base through buyouts and layoffs. And then, you know, you've also got to fix the business and sort of right that ship. Plus, you know, walking into what has to be, at the very least, a tricky environment between the shareholders and the founders and the investors. So that's no small matter.
Right. That's fair. That's true indeed. So what are the next steps that we're going to see in the timeline here of the Outcome Health story?
Well, they've got to find a CEO. There's still a matter of an investigation led by Dan Webb, who the company hired once the allegations that something wasn't quite right first surfaced. You know, they hired Dan Webb, and that investigation's not finished. That's going to go a long way to sort of straightening out, what was the problem and is it fixed? Then you've also got an issue with the advertisers, with the customers, in which, you know, the company said, look, we're going to audit all of the advertising, make sure that you all got what you paid for. I don't think that's completely finished yet. And, you know, some customers, some advertisers, some pharma companies, have said, hey, we're just not going to advertise, and they've sort of backed out. Others are taking a wait and see mode. So they've got to get that settled. They've got to figure out, how pervasive was the problem? Is the problem fixed? And can you rebuild the trust with the customers? Are they okay with it? And we'll see. But that's not a small thing.
Right. I think we've talked about so many companies on this program of in a variety of different issues in which as soon as that kind of bad blood, as soon as there's a little bit of a crack in the relationship with the customer, it is often so difficult to rebuild from that. Even when cleared from wrongdoing, even when, it's just, I think it's hard for the group customer mind to forget. So it will be interesting. So we will keep turning to you as this story continues to unfold. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, John Pletz. We're senior reporter at Cranes.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Okay, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. But I do hope that you are getting outside at some point today to soak in some of that sunshine, because it is lovely. I'm sitting here looking out over Michigan Avenue. I'm not seeing a lot of parkas and scarves and stuff today. I'm seeing people just kind of soaking it in, and I am all in favor of that. So still lots to talk about on the show today. We're joined now by Don Lee, who is a reporter at LA Times, who wrote about Janet Yellen's legacy as chairwoman of the Federal Reserve now that she is stepping down, and what her about her biggest accomplishments and what unfinished business she is leaving behind. Welcome to the program, Don Lee. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. How are you?
Great. Thank you. Thanks for being with us and taking part of your Saturday to talk with us. So talk us through this piece that you here at the LA Times was a really, thoughtfully done kind of profile, but also kind of a critical look, too, of sort of the legacy, good and bad, warts and all, and kind of next steps and a bit of a forecasting of what we might expect to see.
Sure. Well, my colleague in the Washington Bureau, Jim Puzinger, and I had a piece this week, and Janet Yellen is leaving as the Fed chair February 3rd, and she'll be replaced by Jerome Powell, and she's only serving one term. And in the last three, several Fed chairs have served at least two terms, and I think many people feel that Janet Yellen should have been renominated for a second four-year term, but President Trump went with someone else. I think, when Janet Yellen came on in early 2014, much of the hard work in terms of implementing rate cuts and initiating these, extraordinary or unconventional monetary policies to help the economy get out of the Great Recession and the slow recovery, they were already placed by her predecessor, Ben Bernanke. So one of the things that Janet Yellen was tasked to do was not only to keep that going, but to, decide when she and her colleagues at the Fed would start to cut off the stimulus and then gradually raise rates as the economy was strengthening. So when she came on, the unemployment rate was, 6.7%, was close to 7%, and she's leaving with the unemployment rate at about 4%, which is really essentially full employment. And so she's, I think she will be remembered and credited for what she did and her policies that she led that helped to bring down unemployment, which is a very important part of what the Fed's job is. The Fed has a dual mandate. Besides maximizing employment, it's tasked to control inflation, make sure prices don't get out of hand. And the problem that the Fed has had, which is part of the unfinished business that Yellen will be leaving behind, is that inflation has fallen and persistently been below the Fed's 2% target. And I think she would have liked to have stayed around to see the rate go up and then develop policies in this sort of new economic environment in which it seems interest rates and inflation and a number of, and growth are all less than what we've had historically. And so, you know, it's in a sense a mixed legacy because she hasn't really had enough time to do all the things that I think she probably wanted to do.
Right, right. Well, I was kind of thinking that perhaps, unfortunately, her legacy might be marked a bit by the fact that she, you know, had this short, you know, much shorter time to do her work, given that it's traditional for an incoming president to extend the term of the person nominated in that role of the Fed chief. So, you know, it's like a, you know, it's almost as if this kind of looming, this thing will hang over her a bit as like a kind of a mark, as she's the one that kind of got the rug pulled out from under her after such a long tradition of longer terms of federal chairs.
I think that's right. And, you know, as you said, regardless of party affiliation, presidents have tended recently to renominate the Fed chair. You know, assuming that person had done a good job, and I think most people would agree that she's had a good record and successfully and carefully managed monetary policy and forged consensus among policymakers and communicated very clearly and articulately. That's been one of her strengths.
Right.
As in terms of you know, she's been with the Fed for many years, and she was previously a professor at Berkeley in the business school, and so she has a lot of experience, and I think the ability to communicate difficult and technical economic terms and trends in a way that is accessible to people, and I think that was evidenced in, you know, when she made appearances in Congress and in press conferences and other things that she did, and I would also point out that one of the things that she did do more than her predecessor was to try to get out in the field. She went to job training sites. She visited with workers in various cities. And I think she wanted to get a, you know, a better sense of how policy was working on the ground. And I think she made an effort to do that. And it seemed that she really did enjoy that, too.
Did you get the sense working on this piece, and I will tweet this story out that appears at LATimes.com, but if you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet this story out because I want everybody to be able to fully read and absorb all the work that you put into reporting this. But did you get the sense in working on this that there was a great deal of controversy? I mean, I've seen it anecdotally on social media, how people feel about Jerome Powell as the incomer. But, you know, he seems like a controversial choice in an interesting way, only because he is a Republican, and yet he is someone who has seemed to have been a very long supporter of Yellen's and has seemed very loyal to her and all of her work.
That's right. I think people have viewed this precisely in that way, that if you're looking for, if you're going to bring on somebody who's very different and you want to take the, you know, monetary policy in a different direction, then it's understandable that you would pick someone else. But if you're going to bring in somebody who has been fully supportive of what Janet Yellen has done, and as far as credentials are concerned, it's hard to argue that his is, you know, much greater or far superior. And so people are wondering, well, you know, if you're going to have continuity, why wouldn't you just keep the person there? Then you would be insured of having that. And I think, you know, President Trump has made it clear that he wanted to bring in his own person. I think that has a lot to do with it. And, yeah, Janet Yellen is a Democrat and was appointed by a Democrat. And so there is always politics in central bank, I think, nominations. And that probably figured into it, but I think you're right that, you know, people are scratching their heads a bit, you know, in terms of, well, you know, Yellen probably deserves a second term, and the person coming in isn't expected to do anything different or better.
Right, right.
Although it's yet to be seen.
Yeah, I think that's what's kind of gotten people, as you said, scratching their heads, because if you are a supporter of Yellen's, you know, you're possibly thinking she deserved longer time. If you're not, then perhaps it is bewildering why she was replaced by someone who is so much in alignment with her. So it is a topic I'm sure we will continue to analyze as we go forward. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Don Lee, reporter at LA Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking about social media, but an aspect of it perhaps we are not talking about enough. More when we come back here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You know, we talk a lot about social media on this program, plenty of times, both in the business side and as the business side of the big tech giants evolves and moves and makes choices, both wise and questionable. And we also talk about our own use and participation in social media and the news cycle, the role that social media users play in the news cycle. But one thing we don't talk about very often, I think maybe we have not talked about this at all, esteemed producer Griffin Filipich, is the idea of social media fraud, which is becoming a more widely discussed issue. And there is a piece in the New York Times this week about, it's called The Follower Factory, and it is profiling a company that is somehow, I'm not really sure how, because it doesn't seem like they are doing so legally, but they're skating outside of what Twitter has described as, like, what Twitter's terms of service are, that you cannot buy retweets or followers or anything like that. But yet, essentially, this company is doing so. They are buying, they're making these fraudulent accounts and selling people the ability to be more influential online, which seems like, what time are we living in? And I hate to be like, you kids get off my lawn about it, but really that just seems, it is the social part of social media that makes it work. It is, you know, for Twitter in particular, which this piece in New York Times focuses on most, it is the cocktail party you're supposed to go to and essentially talk to strangers. If a stranger's not civilized, you block them. But for the most part, serendipity intervenes and you can connect with people around the world over common interests or news stories or whatever. But this is a whole other level of things. And the New York Times actually purchased some, as a test, as an experiment, purchased some followers to see what it looked like and what it was. And it was really fascinating, the results. The piece also talked to some people who had done this. One was an Olympic gold medalist, a British rower who bought about, I think, 50,000 followers from this company called Devumi. And, it is a really, really fascinating story, but it is one of those where it just keeps, it's a long story, but as you keep digging into it, it gets stranger and stranger, don't you think, Griffin?
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of know that these things are out here, and you hear that celebrities that have millions of followers, people will say offhandedly, oh, like half of those are fake, but no one actually goes through and checks, or I haven't anyway.
Right, nor do I think we analyze what the stakes are of that.
Yeah, that's true, and where they come from. And this is sort of an in-depth look at who has these, I imagine there's a lot of companies that do this. This is more of a close look at one.
Yeah, the piece opens with talking with a teenage girl who lives in Minnesota, and she has an online identity she did not create.
Right.
It is with, you know, adult content. It is bots. It is like all this content, but it is this huge account with a lot of influence and a lot of power. And it is obviously a problem in her life.
Yeah,
you know?
And just to be clear, it's her picture and name,
but
and
she didn't
the same
do it. Yeah.
Bio,
it's not her
as her regular Twitter
right.
account, but she didn't set it up. So the posts that it makes come from, it's sort of hard to tell, but companies that paid for this account, I suppose.
Because it's really, at the end of the day, it's about buying influence. It's about, like, so you look like you have a lot of influence online. And if you're trying to sell something that you need influence in order to sell, you have a better shot of being picked to do so. This is really what this is about. It's not necessarily to tweet out links to something. It's so that you can endorse something with a lot of visibility.
Right. So it doesn't just do Twitter followers. It also people can pay for views on YouTube, plays on SoundCloud, the music hosting site, and endorsements on LinkedIn, the website that you go for like job applicants and stuff like that. And then it says
that one seems most shady to me. You know, I mean, imagine you're hiring some leadership or a really key trusted position in your company. Not that all positions aren't trusted, but you know, someone who has financial data or some, you know, internal secrets or something like that. Obviously, you're going to interview them and do your due diligence on that person. But if you're like, wow, these really big heavy hitters in Silicon Valley really like this candidate, I'd be a fool not to hire them. When it's like, oh, that's Mark Zuckerberg with two G's, or you know what I mean? Like these fraudulent accounts. That's, that becomes really, I mean, all of it is fraud, but that seems like the stakes are very high and very clear in that particular platform of
LinkedIn.
And
in a lot of cases, it seems like the accounts just have to be, look real enough just to be serviceable. Like, oh, maybe that's a real person on first glance, but the identity doesn't actually matter so much. It's just the number.
Right.
You just buy 50,000 followers. I think for something like about a penny a follower. So one of the numbers I think said that that would run you about 25,000 runs you about $2,000 or something like that for in one of these cases anyway.
Well, let's see. In April, the New York Times set up a test account on Twitter. They paid Davumi $225 and they got 25,000 followers.
Right, yeah. So
They said the first 10,000 or so looked like real people. They had pictures, names, hometowns, authentic seeming, you know, bios. It all seemed legit. But then after that, after the next, like the next 15,000 or so started to look a little sketchy. No pictures, no, you know.
But again, who's really going to click through to see that? What you're paying for is the number. You want to be perceived as having this many followers.
Right.
And there's a number of things that can, tangible things that can be traded for that. Like they talk about Kathy Ireland, who's a model that has over 1 million followers, but a lot of those are fake, I guess. And she does like endorsement deals to promote things on that account.
Mm-hmm.
So if only, say, around 160,000 of those are real followers, which is what this alleges, then that's a big difference from whatever company pays. Now, another company pays to her to promote things on that account to just 1 million bots that you know, don't have any purchasing power.
Right. Well, that's so the thing.
That's very tangible. But then for some of the other people, it's not as tangible as that. You wonder, what exactly are you paying for? But like Ray Lewis, the former NFL player, and John Leguizamo, actors and public figures, where it's more
like
hard to tell what exactly you're getting for your money. But you just want that to
an
be
air of legitimacy. To be perceived as famous. Like this is a strange time we live in. I mean, to me, what's next then is that advertisers are going to have to get more sophisticated about this and think, well, we need a way to measure not just the volume of followers, but the value of them.
Yeah, there's 1 million questions that come from this story. I guess the big one is like, are they committing a crime by using people's identities to set up these accounts? I imagine that the answer is yes, but I'm not an expert on that. But it seems like some form of fraud, so they might be in trouble. But then,
or it might be another thing that we say often on the show is that it's another example of where the law has not yet caught up with user behavior online.
Yeah, I just am not sure. And this is a brand new story. So we'll see. But
we're going to have to get ourselves like a legal tech correspondent, because we run into this predicament all the time, Griffin, where we're like, what? I wonder if that's illegal.
Yeah.
Sure. Let's say sure. Or let's say not yet.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to, if you are a legal tech person and you would like to be that person, let us know. We need a correspondent on this show. That's what we need. Well, we're almost out of time already. So we're going to take a break and get things turned over to the Startup Showcase. Maybe he can help us with this answer. Maybe he knows about that. So more in just a bit here on 720 WGN.